Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Thanks, as always, for joining us here on The Avid Reader. I really appreciate your support for the bookstore, Wellington Square Bookshop. And thanks so much for hanging in there with us and letting us do great during this time, which is, I guess, over. So our guest today is Rose Eveleth, author of Flash Forward, An Illustrated Guide to Possible and Not So Possible Tomorrows. Rose is the host of the acclaimed podcast, Flash Forward, which is kind of a precursor of the book and is in its, I think, sixth year with hundreds of episodes. So the future. Well, we just visited it, and now it's in the past. And now we're again in the future, and now that's in the past. And we await the next future in an instant. See, that's the problem with the whole future thing. We have no idea what it is or what it will be. This interview could end in a moment because of a power failure, because Rose gets sick of me, probably, and terminates our connection. Or the sun could explode, and 8 minutes later, there would be no future. Or would there? It's like the weather. Everyone talks about it, but no one does anything about it. Rose talks about the future all the time, but not her fault. Not only can she not predict it or much about it, she has no idea what it will be, but she certainly tries. So you go from Edward Bellamy's Looking Backward, H.G. Wells's The Time Machine, Brave New World, 1984, or even Nostradamus, and thousands more. People predict the end of the world, flying cars, conscious AI, alien life. One of the problems is now when you write, the future is sometimes here already. So flash forward in 12 chapters illustrated as a series of graphic short stories. We're immersed in a world that is possible, actually quite familiar in a way. And since you can't see the graphics, let me tell you, they are amazing. And we'll talk about them and some attribution today. Her introduction kind of lays out a map that we'll follow as we travel through what might or might not be our tomorrows. After each story, Rose gives us an essay of sorts, which delves a little deeper into the concept of the previous tale. Bottom line, just as in the podcast, not only are we provided a glimpse of what may come, but we're kind of ignited by a fuse of curiosity to dream our own tomorrows while we tread our quotidian way or as we sleep and dream. So with that, welcome, Rose, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. That was a lovely introduction.
Oh, thank you. Well, before we begin in earnest, why don't you go back and tell us a little bit about your podcast for those who don't know it, and then perhaps we can handle the illustrators, because although we could show a page or two, we can't really give the flavor of it.
Sure, yeah. So Flash Forward is, as you said, a show about the future. The show tries to kind of blend audio fiction, a little bit of kind of old school War of the Worlds style, traveling into different times, plus, you know, journalistic reporting. So my background is in science. I loved science fiction. I still love science fiction from when I was a kid up till now. And then I went to grad school for journalism. And so this is kind of a way for me to very selfishly just blend all the things I'm interested in into one fun little package. So every episode is a different future scenario. And it starts with, yeah, like a little picture of the world, an audio drama. Sometimes we do television commercials. Sometimes we do a scene from the future, all kinds of things to try and get you into that world. And then it's followed with a bunch of interviews with people who are either trying to make this world happen, trying to stop that future from happening, whatever the case may be, depending on the episode. And so the book kind of mimics that style, right? Having the fictional bit at the top and then sort of a more journalistic conversation afterwards.
But in this case, and it's a great book, and since I own a bookstore, we'll talk a little bit about the cover and the epigraph, but you've turned the whole medium into a visual one in this book. But it's a visual one that younger people are very familiar with. Old men like me aren't. So talk about how it became a graphic illustration and a little bit, if you want to, about the people, also about, I guess, Matt and Sophie too.
Yeah. So, you know, I had Flash Forward, as you said, it's a six-year-old podcast now. And I think anytime you have a podcast that gets to a certain level of success, you start getting emails from people being like, when's the book? Where's the book? When's the book gonna happen? You know? And I love books. Books are great, but I could not for the life of me figure out a book adaptation that felt like it would be satisfying to me as a reader that I would want to read. If I was a listener to the podcast, you know, I don't really want to just take the transcripts and turn them into a book. That doesn't really feel satisfying. Writing for audio is really different than writing for the page, right? You're just, it's a different kind of thing. You know, we talked a little bit, I talked with my agent a little bit about, well, what if I wrote sort of more like full short stories and then had, you know, writing afterwards. And I was like, ah, you know, I just like wasn't, nothing quite, you know, grabbed me to do. And then Sophie Goldstein, who is an amazing comic artist, who is one of the co-editors of the book and has a comic in the book, was a listener of the show, emailed me and actually suggested, hey, have you ever considered doing this kind of comics interpretation? And that was really, I mean, it's full credit to Sophie for having the idea for this, because I would never have thought of that on my own. I didn't have any idea what went into making comics. I've certainly read them and enjoyed them, but it wouldn't be something that I thought like, oh yes, I could do that, because I didn't know really how it was done. And so we brought in Maddie Lipchansky, and together we all kind of like put it together. And it was incredibly amazing to learn from my side of things. You know, I've done audio production for many years. I've written for magazines and newspapers, but I've never done anything in the comics realm before. And so it was really fun to put that together with them and have it come out that way. And it just felt like the right way to do it. It was the only way that made sense once Sophie suggested it. And we did a book event a couple of weeks ago. And I didn't know this, but Sophie admitted that at the book event that when she emailed me, she had thought we would make like a zine and not, you know, a hardcover like print out book that with 200 pages or whatever it is. So but it's been really fun to work on. And yeah, I learned a ton about comics.
Yeah, and the thing about it is, like I said, and I've said this so many times, but as many times as you'll hear, you can't judge a book by its cover. Everyone who comes into my bookstore judges the books by a cover. And it's really cool because they must really like you because they gave you a really cool cover and this really thick, people have to pick it up. And here, you have it in front of you?
There, I do. Yes, always have my copy ready. No, I mean, and maybe all authors feel this way, particularly first-time authors. You know, I spend so much of my time making a podcast, which is digital, right? And, you know, rarely do I write for print magazines anymore. So rarely do I get to, you know, hold a thing in my hands and be like, this is it. And, you know, we worked on the book for a long time, as you do with books, but it was all obviously on screens and everything. And I had a little bit of nervousness because I had heard horror stories from other comic artists that sometimes the printing, you know, the colors aren't quite what you want, or it doesn't quite look the way you wanted it to look. And so when they first got the box, you know, in the mail and got to pick it up and open it, it was just so, it just looks so good. And Abrams was an incredible publisher partner on it. And they did such a good job making it look really, really good. And even the artists, you know, they all got their copies and I got some emails from them being like, oh, it looks so good, which is so exciting.
It really does. And it's got so much heft to it, you know? And so, like I said, they decided, okay, we're really going to push this. And Abrams is a great publisher. And if you look at the cover, each of the kind of like the 12 different looks at a possible future are kind of in there. And it's funny because your friend, Annalee Newitz, I interviewed her for Autonomous. So if you look at the top one with the pills, there's a parallel one. So we can't go through all of them, but let's start with that one, because that book Autonomous dealt with, you know, pirating drugs and things like that. And that's something that actually, you know, I've interviewed lots of authors about what's happening with generic drugs and how they're made and the quality of them. So talk a little bit about that story. And also the graphic elements in that are excellent.
Yeah, before I do that, I will tell you a fun connection between Annalee and this book, which is that the podcast, Flash Forward, started because Annalee was working at Gizmodo and we were friends, and they emailed me being like, hey, do you have any podcast ideas? And I was like, boy, do I. And so the first season of this show was at Gizmodo with Annalee. So I owe a lot to Annalee. They're amazing. Their books are amazing. I think their work is amazing. So yes, so that chapter is illustrated by John Jennings, who is incredible, incredible artist. And just a joy to work with. You know, all artists have their own kind of style and vibe, and his point of view and style is so unique and just like comes through really well. And the comic is basically following a character who goes from sort of being essentially a DEA agent, someone who's trying to track down people who are making these pirated drugs and understand what this sort of underground world is like, but also has his own connection to it because this, you know, the character's partner is suffering and doesn't have access to drugs. And it's kind of about the ethical quandary that this character has around, do you bust the people who are making the drugs that work, or do you try to join them, right? What, like, who fighting for good and who decides, and, you know, who has access to different things. And it is a beautiful, all of the comics have a really amazing and different color palette. And this one has this sort of beautiful rust colored palette that I think is just, really lovely. And it, as soon as it came in, John's just, his comics look so unique to him. And he has a lot of other amazing work out there that folks should seek out. A lot of it is actually published through Abrams and looks really great as well. So yeah, it was really fun to go from that comic. And, you know, in the process, there is a little bit of a, you know, back and forth as we were putting them together, where every artist got to pick which future they wanted to do. And then we kind of worked on the storyline together. And so that storyline ends up informing the essay, and kind of they are hopefully in conversation with one another in a way that sort of makes them both make sense together. And John was such a joy to work with.
And it's funny too, because when I spoke with Anna Lee, we talked like you were just saying about good and evil. I'm going, okay, is he a good guy or is he a bad guy? And we went on for a few minutes about that. And again, the same thing came into my mind in this story as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's like, I think the ultimate narrative question, like who is good and who is evil, is a pretty tried and true animating tension in narrative, trying to create narratives. And I think that's a big question for the future, right? People who think they're building a better future might, to our eyes, not be building a better future, right? Dystopia is all in the eye of the beholder in many ways, as is utopia. So that's a big theme in, I think, writing about the future and thinking about the future is, you know, which is the good version and which is the bad version, and not everyone's going to have the same answer.
Yeah, which kind of leads to the first story tale, because, you know, when you read it, you go, oh, this could be the future. And then you go, oh, wait a minute, this is happening right now. This is pretty much the way things are. And that's what I was saying earlier in the introduction, you know, it's like you think, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, that, well, no, that's probably pretty much the way things are now. Go and talk about that a little bit, because it's true,
right? And the first chapter is Ben Passmore is the comic artist of that one. And it's about a smart city, right? And much of what you see in that one is truly like, feels like it's really right around the corner, right? That like where our cities are getting smarter, everything is app driven. And at first it seems really... And the story is a character's mother comes to visit. And I love the joke in there where, because she's like a millennial, which means she's very old now in the future, know. You know?
I thought about that because I'm way older than that.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and the mother has her own, you know, at first it seems like she's just a Luddite. She just doesn't really want to work with the technology. And then it becomes clear that, in fact, this technology doesn't work for everyone, right? And this is true now, right? You have facial recognition systems that don't see certain faces as well as other faces, or will flag people as criminals or not, depending on largely, you know, the color of their skin or something like that. And so you see that play out in this comic. And it is very much a real thing for a lot of people right now in terms of the way that they interact with technologies that, you know, are prevalent throughout cities. So it is, you know, a lot of, I love science fiction, and I think it's, I think a pretty well accepted idea that most science fiction is really not about the future. It's trying to get at something that's happening today and sort of suss out what we want to have happen tomorrow. And a lot of what I hope to do with the book is to kind of help people think through sort of that next half step and be like, oh, we could very easily go into that future from today, right? Wouldn't be hard at all. Do we want to, is the question, right? And kind of having people start thinking about what some of those ripple effects might be and whether or not that is a future that we want to kind of just like jollily hike on into, you know, without asking any questions.
Yeah, it's like when I first read, and probably when you first read, the Foundation trilogy, and, you know, Harry Seldon, I'm thinking, you know, I wonder if you could ever get to the point where from one little thing you could predict everything down the line. And I started at first, it was, you know, it's incredible, you know, you couldn't possibly do that. But now 50, 60 years later, it almost seems like that's something that could possibly happen, right?
Yeah, although at the same time, then there are these like turning point events that no one predicts, right? And I think that's like
that's
the
true.
Sort of the, you never know when that's going to happen. I mean, there are certain things, you know, to speak to the pandemic, right? You know, we did an episode on Flash Forward about a pandemic 4.5 years ago now. And people will be like, oh, you predicted it. And if you talk to experts in that field, they all say it's just a question of when, not a question of if, right? This is going to happen. It happened. This is how what we know. And so there are certain things I think that, you know, might seem random when they happen. And no one can say, you know, on this day or this month and this year, it's going to happen. But you can kind of say like, okay, probably in the next 5 to 10 years, you'll see these things, because that's humans are both very unpredictable and very predictable at the same time. It's sort of our nature.
Yeah, and part of it also, I'm wrong about it, actually, because there's chaos, the old butterfly wings in East Africa, West Africa, where all of a sudden it turns into a hurricane, and no, it's chaotic. Right. And that's a part of the book that's kind of addressed too, in a way, is like, like you say, it's like the movie Sliding Doors. I mean, if you see if you don't see that person in that moment, your entire life changes.
Yeah.
That's a different kind of future, isn't it, than what you're talking about?
Yeah. And I think there's this feeling, I think, about the future that can be very scary, which is that it feels both absolutely unknowable and also sort of preordained in some ways, right? Especially when it comes to technology. I think we're fed every day lots and lots of messages around how like, oh, well, you can't stop the inevitable march of technology and there's nothing to do and this is the way it is and this is what's going to happen. And, wealthy people like to sort of make it seem like the only way forward is via these billionaires who want to, invent X, Y, or Z thing. And that's very disheartening. And then you have the side of chaos, which is terrifying. And so a lot of people are very afraid of thinking about the future for very good reasons, because it doesn't feel good. It feels like you have no agency and it feels like a little bit terrifying. And part of what I'm trying to do a little bit with both the podcast and the book is to highlight the places where, yes, you probably can't, snap your fingers and change the world exactly, but you can kind of start to fiddle at the margins in a way that is better than just sort of waving your hands and saying, oh, well, I give up.
I know, it's funny in the introduction, two things. One is when you have I love your footnotes too. It's when you talk about, basically guys in black turtlenecks and jeans on TEDx talks with their little microphone. And the other one is arguing that whales are better off now because plastic has eliminated the need to get ambergris and all the other stuff out of them. So yeah, everyone, whether you're a Luddite or not, you can each take different viewpoints. And, I guess bottom line is, who am I to say? I don't know. It's like everything else. We're so polarized now with everything for example, one of the other stories, the art exhibit of hell. And I thought a lot about the person being down there, but not being down there. And that's, yeah, I tend to go on and interview myself, but go ahead and you tell about that one.
Sure. Yeah. So that is a chapter about whether or not AI can make art, right? And like, what do we consider art? What does it mean to make art if you are an artificial intelligence? And Julia Graffaire, who drew that comic, picked it actually because, I gave each artist the whole list of 100 episodes being like, pick your top three, and then I'll kind of distribute them across to make sure that we're not doubling up and we have a good sort of distribution across the chat of the book. And she picked that one because she found it so offensive, that the idea that an AI could make art as an artist, she was like, absolutely not. So she really like was drawn to it because she had such an emotional reaction to like even the idea that that could be a thing. And so in the chapter, you have these art students who are entering a contest around kind of AI driven art. And there's this kind of debate about who is the art for. If a human can't process it or regard it, if it's only something that an AI can kind of understand, what does that mean? So the piece that you're referring to is about basically, and they fed an AI system all of the like historical literary descriptions of hell and had it sort of spit out like what is hell to this AI. And to them, it was a big hole, big black hole. And somebody had to go down there naked and stand in the bottom of the hole. But to a human, you would never know if that person was down there, right? All you see is a big black pit. And so it was kind of this conversation around like, does it matter if there is actually someone standing down there if you can't see them? And kind of that was like the piece of art. And they had all these sort of like debates about the nature of art and the nature of perception and the nature of being the audience for an art piece. And it was a very fun one to have Julia work on. Julia mostly makes horror comics. And so this was sort of a little bit of a break from her usual topics. So it was really a joy to have her.
And like I said at the beginning, it's not that the story ends and it's all wrapped up and done with. I mean, I spent a lot of time after reading that one thinking about, you know, Christianity. People have faith, but there's nothing to really base it on. They just have faith. So, and in the story, it's saying, hey, you don't need to look down there. She's down there. You just have to have faith that she's down there. And then, so then the other thing I started thinking about was consciousness and whether you need to have a consciousness in order to create art.
Yeah. And many people have a wide variety of opinions about that, right? And like, it gets into sort of like fundamental questions of like, what is art? Like, what do we mean when we say art? Does it have to mean something, and to whom? And, you know, I think the other thing I find interesting around the trust, like you have to believe that someone is down there. There's a lot of trust in, you know, the black box of technology, right? A lot of these algorithmic systems, you know, the way that they work, you can't actually explain to anyone how it came to the conclusion that it came to. And we are more and more putting trust in those systems, those black box systems that we cannot explain. And like, do we want to be doing that? Is that a good thing or a bad thing, right? Like, that's a question I think we'll have to ask more and more as these systems sort of become more pervasive.
Yeah, it's like, okay, I'm gonna try not to explain this one for 3 minutes before I let you answer. So talk about the one where technology has advanced to the point where you can essentially create a doppelganger of yourself in the event you're gone.
Yes, this is sort of a classic sci-fi idea, I think. This idea of either robot clones or sort of when someone dies, creating sort of a robot version of them. And in this particular adaptation of that idea, Kate Sheridan is the artist, and there, I love that one. I think the color palette is so beautiful. It's like pastel, and it's really, I think the thing I love about that interpretation of kind of like a classic sci-fi idea is that it's really like emotional and intimate and kind of about the relationship between a woman who is dying of cancer and her wife. And her wife decides that they want to make this or get this sort of AI version of her, this robot version of her, humanoid robot, to help, you know, carry on her legacy and also to help raise their kid. And there's a lot of conversation around like, how do you want to be remembered? How do you, you know, and in this case, the person who is dying and their soon to be replacement are alive and existing together at the same time, because she has to train it to make sure that it's really kind of like getting her correct. And what is that experience like, to have to train this robot that you know is going to kind of become you once you die, as if dying itself is not already confusing and hard enough, you know? And so it's just this lovely portrait of like, is that really what we want? Is that the right way, you know, big air quotes, to deal with grief? You know, can a humanoid robot ever actually replace a person, or are they just mimicking that person? Sort of similar to the art conversation, like you said. So it was kind of, yeah, it's kind of this look at some of these devices, and it's all based on, there's a more and more real companies that are offering this kind of service, not with the humanoid robot to go with it, but sort of a chat bot that will look or that will sound like and act like your loved one. So they can train it before they die or after they die based on oral histories or interviews or whatever it is.
Yeah, it's like the Turing test. And in your case, I mean, I have no idea if you exist. I mean, solipsistically, one of us might be talking to the other and the other one isn't there. So you could actually be the doppelganger of the person you were and not be here. Well, I would have absolutely no idea. There's no way I could possibly tell.
We did an episode about that actually for Flash Forward. It's not in the book, but there is an episode about digital twins. And there's a company where you can hire them to create a digital twin of you, which will be much more effective via Zoom as opposed to in person. And they can, you know, the sales pitch is they can go on dates for you and see if that person's a good fit. And then you show up for the second date in your real form, and like in all of these different things where I'm like, oh my God.
Well, it's like the guy that you talk about in your commentary, you know, who was able to create, because of interviewing the father who was dying of cancer, who was able to essentially be able to still communicate with them, and how some of the people really enjoyed the process and others were, it was anathema to them.
Yes, this is something that was really interesting to me talking to James Vlahos, who is the person you're referring to. And then also another person I interviewed for the episode, the podcast episode of that chapter, did it without telling his family. And then, which I didn't realize, I was interviewing him and I was like, oh, what does your family think? And he was like, oh yeah, though they don't know that this exists. And I was like, that seems extra weird. But he was going to tell them, I can't remember if it was like a 4th of July barbecue. It was like some kind of like, they were all going to get together and he was going to unveil this app, this thing where you could speak to, it was also his father. And so I followed up with him afterwards and was like, how did it go? Right? Like, how did people respond? And it was similar. He was like, some people were super into it and other people were like, absolutely not. I want nothing to do with this.
Hey, have you ever thought about doing a video before you die saying, hey, if you guys are watching this, I'm gone, and then start talking about other people? I guess everyone's done that. Have you done that?
No, I haven't thought about it. I have talked to friends and family about like, A, I don't want to be made into a Vocaloid. I don't want to be like, once I'm gone, I'm gone. But also, and this is sort of, this is not really about the future, but I was like, don't publish my letters. Don't publish my diaries. Not that I would ever be that famous, but like anytime I see like Virginia Woolf's secret diaries, and I'm like, she didn't want anyone to read those. Like, I don't know. Like, it just feels very like, just burn it all. I don't want anyone reading it.
Well, the worst one, which gives me, I have no idea morally whether it's right or not, is Kafka telling Max Brod, you know, burn all this shit. And if he did, we wouldn't have, you know, the trial and the castle and America and Metamorphosis. And I'm thinking, well, so Max Brod broke the last, you know, the promise this guy made on his dying bed. And I always wondered,
was it worth it? Yeah. Right. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, it is. I feel very like it's like, or, you know, the example I always think of is like Prince didn't want a bunch. He made so many albums that he never wanted people to release. And now they're starting to release them. And like, part of me's like, man, just like he's allowed to control that. I don't know. I feel very, so that's the one thing I've told friends and family is like, burn all of my papers. There's no the trial in any of my journals. Like, trust me, you know, like.
Do you think they'll listen to you?
Good question. Probably, I would say.
Yeah, the same thing's true of Jimi Hendrix. Back in my day, I mean, it was like all these albums came out after he died, and it just, I know he would not have wanted them. Even that song that the Beatles did where they reconstructed, what's it called? Free as a Bird. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, yeah, I don't know if John would have really wanted this, more of a demo track, you know, that kind of thing. But it made me happy watching it too, though.
Yeah. So, yeah. I don't know. I feel very, it's funny. I actually have had this argument with Anna Leibovitz, and they're just like, they're dead. Who cares? You're dead. Doesn't matter.
You know? Yeah, I know. My family has been doing all this planning for our business, and we're in the second generation, and my kids are the third generation, and their kids are the fourth generation. I'm thinking, you know how the Native American thing about don't make a decision until you think about how it will affect the seventh generation? Mm-hmm. I really can't. I can't do that. It's too exhausting, and I don't really care.
Yeah. I mean, that is like what the climate change thing too, right? Trying to really think about how our actions are gonna impact the planet and the people on it many generations from now, and we have not done that.
No, and that's the other thing is that you look at, here's a question, is it worth trying? Say on climate change, look at Greta. I mean, one of the persons I admire more than anyone in the world. Mm-hmm. I don't even know if she thinks she can make a change, but she knows she has to do what she's doing. Mm-hmm. And that's another part of the future is, I mean, is it worth it for you to recycle? Does it make any difference when China is spewing out way more than you can ever save by throwing plastic bottles in a different can?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that, and this is something that comes up a lot on Flash Forward, which is, you know, so much of these conversations center around personal responsibility when the personal, there are things that do impact the planet if you personally do them, right? So there's research that shows that even if you recycling that one bottle doesn't do anything, right? It's a drop in the giant ocean. But there is research that shows that what you are doing when you are recycling is signaling to the people around you that it's important to care, and that like sort of communities as a whole will shift more and more towards things like composting and other sort of collective behaviors that do make a difference. But yeah, I mean, I think that one of the biggest schemes and scams of sort of like where we're at in terms of the power that corporations have is them all convincing you that it's your responsibility to change climate change and not the 10 companies that, you know, are spewing the vast majority of the fossil fuels into the environment. Now, I don't think that means that any of us can say like, well, what are you gonna do? Like nothing I can do, right? Because when I talk about sort of rejecting the cult of personal responsibility because it sort of puts all the burden on consumers, that doesn't mean you just give up. It means that you shift where you're putting your energy in terms of like the pressure you're trying to apply. And that means like just changing your tactics as opposed to giving up completely. But yeah, I mean, personal carbon footprint calculators were literally invented by British Petroleum because they wanted to shift the blame onto consumers for your personal carbon footprint, as if that is an answer to, and like they were created by fossil fuel corporations so that you would feel like it's your responsibility and not theirs, even though that makes no sense.
I know, it's like when they have symposia about climate change and I think all these people are flying in from all over the world to talk about why you shouldn't be flying in from all over the world.
Right.
Yeah, it's funny. Oh, yeah. One of the smaller things, which is really an enormous thing that I actually, and I'm a fatalist, but one of the things I actually think, okay, this might actually work, are honeybees. Because honeybees, you know, you don't think about it, but then you realize they're pollinating like 66% of the flora on the planet. And I actually think that's one that people are starting to become aware of. Even myself from personal experience, I had this honeybee infestation in my roof and I thought, oh, I got to get someone to exterminate them. And I go, no, I have to get someone to relocate them. So I actually, that was one I actually thought about.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we have examples of doing the right thing, right? So, you know, the hole in the ozone layer is not 100% closed, but that is an example of like identifying a problem, everyone being like, okay, let's not do that. This is bad. Let's do something and making a change. And it's gotten much, much better, right? So like, it is not impossible for us to do that. It just requires, I think, a big shift in power and thinking around who gets to make those decisions and taking power away from corporations, right? Like that is like, when I think about like positive futures, it's less about like, ooh, do you have like the cool new technological thing? And more about like, have we made the big picture structural changes that we need to make in order for the planet to survive? Well, the planet will be fine without us, in order for us to survive.
Yeah, that's true. You know, that's what I was saying when I made my introduction, you know, suppose something happens and you and I are gone, the planet's fine. And it doesn't, you know, it's like the strong and the weak anthropomorphic principle, anthropic principle, you know, whether we're here because we're conscious of our own existence here or not. But yeah, I don't think there's any question in my mind that the planet would do much better if we weren't here.
I mean, better is such a subjective relative term. Better for whom, right? Like some animals and plants would not exist if humans weren't around. So, you know, just depends on who you're asking and who you are.
Yeah, I figure cockroaches will do great, but you know, because they haven't had to evolve for like 300 million years. Because like they said, you know what, this is fine. We're good.
Yeah.
The other topic, switching gears completely, is there's so much diversity in this book and each of the tales. And then there's one story that talks about gender and the fluidity of gender. Talk about that one a little bit.
Yeah. So the book tries to, it's interesting. People have asked like, oh, you know, did you ever instruct the artist to like add in diversity? And the nice thing is that I never had to say it. I think, you know, indie comics, which is most of the people who worked on the book are from indie comics, is already a pretty diverse space. And it's already a big conversation in that space to kind of have lots of different characters in your pieces. So I never had to give a note being like, hey, can we, you know, add in, you know, whatever. That particular chapter is by Ziad Ayoub and Blue Del Quanti. And it is about basically a future in which gender becomes kind of like hair color, right? Like you kind of notice it maybe about someone like, oh, okay, I have brown hair, like, or whatever. And I could change my hair. I could dye my hair pink if I wanted to. And people would be like, oh, she has pink hair now. Okay. And gender becomes kind of like that, something that can be sort of fluid and change, and everyone's just sort of like chill about it. And I think that's maybe the most hopeful chapter in the book, because it is a really sweet story about these two friends who have gone through many, many years of knowing each other, and sort of both of them have gone through different phases of their presentation and ways in thinking about gender. One of them is now pregnant. And it's just like kind of a very sweet, domestic, kind of like meet cute almost story of these two people kind of coming together and sort of looking at this world of a place where, yeah, it just doesn't matter that much, right? There's so much focus, I think, right now around like people declaring gender and giving their pronouns and making it like a big conversation. And then there's important pieces to that. There's really important work to be done around making sure that people feel comfortable and have access to opportunities regardless of their gender. But hopefully in the far future, we can all just like chill out a little bit, you know, and like let people just do whatever they want when it comes to their gender presentation.
Yeah, it's funny, that reminds me, and even in that, you're still bringing technology into it, you know, because that was the first thing you said, even though we're not, you know, it's more like we're talking about soft stuff like love and relationships, but there's still technology involved. And it reminds me, because I've interviewed Andy Weir for The Martian, Artemis, and for the new one, Project Hail Mary, which is already, they already cast the movie before the book was even published.
It's like, a good spot to be in as a writer.
I know, it's like, and it's like Ryan Gosling, the guy in the Maze Runner, and the guy in 12 Years a Slave. Yeah, it's amazing. But the thing about him that's so cool is that he's so smart and so technologically savvy that his books just like seem like, okay, this is basically what's going to happen because we already know all this stuff. Like The Martian, you know, he writes the book and 2 years later, Matt Damon's there playing him. And here I go again. So here's a good question. So in your mind, is Elon Musk a hero, a villain, a combination of the two?
I think Elon Musk is a villain. I think that there is enough now that has come out around the ways in which he works his way into companies, takes credit for other people's inventions, and then pushes them out to suggest that a lot of the things he has given credit for on the technological front are probably overblown. This is the story in a bunch of companies that he sort of like made his way into and then sort of, even at Tesla, he has named himself lead engineer, and a lot of other engineers who've worked there have left and said that he doesn't do the engineering, he just likes the title. And at the same time, he is a person who has a pretty clear record of being sexist and not great to the women in his life. He is not someone who I have any interest in glorifying in any way.
I got this astronaut I interviewed, Terry Vert. I got him really pissed off because I was saying, yeah, in 70 years, NASA hasn't landed on land any booster, and he lands them like 9 times in a row. He was really angry because he said to me, well, he doesn't have any red tape. He doesn't have to go through the government, blah, 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 blah.
Right. He abuses his workers at the Tesla factory. He doesn't care about rules. He's ruining the night sky with Starlink so astronomers can no longer make observations. He only cares about himself.
Yeah, but you're the science fiction person. Isn't this what you want? Isn't this
no,
stuff? Why?
Not at all.
Yeah, but do you not want to go to Mars? Do you not want to be able to land?
I think that is an argument that people love to make to sort of stop people from asking questions, right? Like, oh, I guess you don't want any progress ever. And the question is not, do we ever want progress? The question is it worth the trade-offs that you're currently, you know, doing? And I would say that the trade-offs that Elon Musk is willing to make, which is worker safety, the future of astronomy writ large with Starlink, which is ruining the observations of astronomers across the country, across the globe. They can no longer look at certain planets because there are thousands of satellites now that he's launching without any consultation with astronomers. Those are not trade-offs that we have to make. It's not either we get Elon Musk and all of his stuff or we never go to Mars, right? It is not a dichotomy there. We could have other options if we were to choose to exercise them. It's just that people have sort of set up this false binary where it's either you get the sort of like super villain who you have to put up with, or you get scientific progress, or you get nothing. And that's not true. That's not how it works.
Yeah, but you got Thomas Edison, who was an asshole. You got Steve Jobs, who was an asshole. You got Elon Musk, who was an asshole. Theoretically, you have Jeff Bezos, who's an asshole.
But we could have a different future, right? Like, yeah, this is not inevitable.
But they got a lot of shit done. Maybe you have to be an asshole to get this shit done.
I don't buy that at all. Because there's also lots of people who got a lot of shit done who don't get the same kind of credit because the assholes took credit for it, right? And there's a way to change that. This is like not inevitable. I don't think that we can build a future just assuming that human cruelty is the only way to make progress. I think that's a bad future.
Well, so to continue this dialogue, so like suppose, and going back to the whales. So suppose Starlink links up people who would never have had access to internet. And now because of those satellites, they do, and they can communicate, they can learn, they can pull themselves up to a different socioeconomic position than they had before.
So far, my understanding, based on all the data that I've seen and all the promotional material that Starlink has made, Starlink will not actually be cheaper for anybody in the world than traditional infrastructure is right now. And again, like, we're sort of positioning a false dichotomy. Either you get Elon Musk and Starlink, or these people have the same life they always had, nothing changes, right? The money that is being spent on certain projects could be used in other ways that might help them more. There's a really great interview, I forget the name of the journalist, who went out and talked to a lot of people who are often used as this example, right? People who might not have access to the internet right now, but could potentially have it. And they ask them, like, do you want, this is what you want? And they're like, no, here's what we want. Elon Musk doesn't go talk to the people that he's using, claiming that they're gonna have X, Y, and Z because of his technology, right? Like, the future, if we wanna build a future that is good, we can think about maybe asking people what they want and maybe building those things instead of assuming that we know best what is going to pull these people out of whatever situation we think that they are in.
Yeah, it's funny. I interviewed this woman who wrote a book called This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, about cyber warfare and how Putin like shut down the Ukraine for an entire day, everything, just shut down everything. And the Ukrainians, when they talked to the United States citizens, they said, it's nothing compared to what's going to happen to you. We aren't sophisticated. We don't run on these things. It's like the Minuteman missile silos. I never worry about getting them hacked because they're so old. They're using like landlines and 5.5-inch floppy disks. So, you know, it's like, yes, your argument does make sense in that context. But at the same time, okay, well, all right, I'm not selling your book now, though, am I? Should we go back to selling the book or just keep
sure,
arguing?
Sure.
Okay. Well, so on the show, on the podcast, you're postulating all these things without, and I don't mean it in a bad way, without knowing. No one knows.
Yeah.
So you're postulating all these things, but both within the book and in your own mind, in your own day-to-day reality, what do you think? What are some of your opinions, if you take the stories in your book, what are some of your opinions about what actually is going to happen? Do you have any certainty, or do you just look at it as a coin flip?
I mean, I don't think it's a coin flip. You know, I think there's also a distinction between sort of like what the show and the book are trying to do, which is like get people thinking about these ideas, and this idea of like, okay, if we really have to sit down and be like, what's gonna happen, right? Those are two slightly different things. A lot of the chapters and episodes of the show and the book are about, okay, let's take this like admittedly zany scenario and use it to kind of like talk about some of these interesting ideas, right? So, you know, next week's episode of the podcast is about mind control, which is not something that we can do, but it's sort of an interesting way to talk and think about sort of like how the brain works and how these neuro-computer interfaces are gonna work or not work or whatever it is. In terms of what I think is fair to say about the future, climate change feels like to me the number one kind of like future wild card, in the sense that we know it's happening. We know it's happening faster than we had hoped. We know that even if we were to hit some of the, you know, Paris Agreement targets, it's going to keep happening probably worse and faster than we kind of hoped if we were going with some of our more moderate projections. Locally, that will be chaotic, right? Right now, we're in the middle of a heat wave in a lot of places. Other places are going to see really extreme weather. We can say that this is going to happen, but what it will look like, you know, minute by minute in different places will be different. But I think that's the big future story, right? Like, forget technology, forget going to the moon. Like, if we want to really think about like, what is life going to be like and how is it going to be different in the next 5, 10, 15 years, climate change has to be front and center for those conversations, because it's just going to become, it has been like happening and everyone kind of knows it. And like, every time there's a big storm, we talk about it, and it's going to go from that to being like front and center day to day, big part of the conversation about the future. And I think that's a pretty easy thing to predict, if that counts as a prediction. And so that's the one I spend a lot of time thinking about. And it's actually a hard one often to, you know, talk about and write about, because people I think are tired of hearing about climate change a little bit, and it's hard to make it feel like new to them. At the same time, like, it's happening, you know, we like need to be aware of it. We need to start talking about it more.
Yeah, and the thing about it is there were so many goals that had to be met by, you know, 2030, 2035. And even if you're optimistic, it's difficult to imagine how those goals could be reached. So basically, if I were a Republican, which I would rather kill myself than be, if you're a Republican, it's just like, okay, well, I'll be dead. It's like we were talking about earlier, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's hard for me to say. I think there's a lot of money to be made in deciding that this doesn't matter right now. There's a lot of political power to be had in, you know, clinging to that narrative, that fantasy. But it's also one of those things where there are many topics on which there is a large disconnect between the public, right? If you were to poll the public on what they think, you know, is happening, right? The vast majority of people believe in climate change, right? There's this, I think, this idea that like half the country doesn't believe in climate change, and that is not true. If you poll people, the vast majority of people in the United States believe that climate change is real and that it is happening. But like the disconnect between that and what certain sections of the political sphere decide is useful to them, because their donors are all people who need that fantasy to continue because that's where the money is for them. You know, there's that gap there. There's a lot of topics like that. You know, gun control being another one where when you poll the majority of the country, they want more regulations and somehow it's impossible, right? So like there is this kind of disconnect. But I do think that that's going to be a less and less tenable position to take, even in places like Texas, right? You saw, you know, there was a huge heat wave in Texas and then there are cold snap in Texas, right? Like it's happening. And, you know, it is not good that it requires, you know, literal experience with it in sort of a very real and often devastating, deadly way for people to kind of start to think about doing something. But I think it will be harder and harder to cling on to that narrative as, unfortunately, as it just becomes more and more obvious that this is happening.
We go to like, to end this up, if we go to like one of the last stories that's kind of like, maybe not as, you know, you and I going back and forth on these, you know, is this right? Is this right? Let's talk about living in the ocean.
Oh yeah, I love that one. That's a fun one. Yeah, I'm a big scuba diver. I love the ocean. I'm obsessed with the ocean. I would live underwater if I could live underwater. Like, I love it. It's like my favorite place to be. So that one's a little bit of just me being like, wouldn't it be cool if we could live underwater? And of course, you know, climate change will mean sea level rise, but the chapter of the book is actually a little bit less about sort of like the sea level rise climate change and more about a world in which basically Venice is underwater, as an underwater place for you to go as your, you know, tourist attraction. As many people probably know, Venice is in not great shape in the current world that we live in. It is over-touristed, and that plus climate change means that it's having a really hard time maintaining, and lots of people have written about sort of Venice sinking and all these things. But we kind of wanted to imagine this world where you could go underwater and like have this kind of tourist attraction thing while also being very real about climate change. And I think this is a thing that I think about all the time, which is the ways in which for a certain set of people, climate change will be kind of annoying, but like not that bad. And there will be sort of an amount of like disaster tourism that happens where like rich people will be able to go to underwater Venice, and it's just gonna be this like thing that they do. And the ways that people will capitalize on some of these disasters is really sort of like pet sort of fascination of mine. We did a whole mini season of Flash Forward in which the intro scenes were all people pitching sort of a fake Shark Tank show with just like dystopian inventions where they're like, don't worry, we can still make money, you know? And so, yeah, thinking about living underwater and what and who gets to go down to underwater Venice and who doesn't, and, you know, getting into the history of SeaLab, which is super fascinating, and all of that. That was a fun one.
Yeah, it's a fun one. And it goes back kind of in conclusion, it goes back to what I said earlier on, is that this book, like many good books, is not a book that you read and then you put back in your library and you just forget about it. Like I said, even if you dream about it or think about it, like even this one, which is the most, it's a bad word to use, but most prosaic of those stories, because it could actually happen and it doesn't take much to go there in your head. But the cool thing about everything you do, from the podcast to this, is that you engage the reader or the listener's imagination, which, you know, sounds Disney-esque, but
I like it.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that
I think cool? You have to. Yeah, I mean, the challenge of reporting on the future, which sounds very obvious, is that it hasn't happened yet, right? There's nothing to show. But exactly. In order to get people to really be thinking about, we need to all be thinking about, like, okay, what do I want to have happen? What futures do I care about? What futures do I not care about? We have to engage in a little bit of, it's psychologists call it mental time travel, is this idea that you can put yourself in the shoes of someone or even in the shoes of yourself in a year, in 5 years, in a week, tomorrow, right? Like, and that is not always easy, but I think it's a really important skill for us all to practice. And so that's part of what I'm trying to do with the book and with the podcast is get people sort of practice that muscle of being able to imagine different futures, imagine what could happen, imagine what you don't want to have happen, maybe think starting to think about how to keep that from happening. You know, all of those pieces, it is like anything. It just takes a little bit of practice. And so hopefully every episode, every chapter, you're just like practicing a little bit how to do that, how to picture that future.
Exactly. That's a good way to end it because if we didn't, I have so many thoughts in my head that the rest of it would just be me talking again, which I think people are pretty much sick of after 10 years of this. So anyway, flash forward, both the podcast at first, and now an illustrated guide to possible and not so possible tomorrows, which is great. It was so nice talking to you today.
Thank you so much for having me. This is fun.
Yeah, it was. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.